So my realization was everybody's failing. And the more people I spoke to, the more I kind of went on this journey of trying to understand why nobody was talking about the massive failure rate at early stage startup. I mean, it's as high as 95% in some tech sectors, 95%. I mean, who, and let me give an Irish analogy here. None of my friends would go to the bar with a 95% chance of not getting a beer. It just wouldn't happen. So yeah. Why the heck would anybody start a business with a 95% chance of failing?
You're listening to Hooked on Startups, where every week you'll hear from some of the most talented, inspiring, and successful entrepreneurs who share their real life stories, how they overcame challenges and failures, and how they mastered success. Get ready for some of the best business tips, tricks and tactics, and some frank, unscripted discussions. Here's your host, Matthew Sullivan.
Today on Hooked on Startups, I am absolutely delighted to have Brian McMahon. So Brian, welcome to the show.
It is my pleasure. If the podcast was not about startups, I would be lost. But startups is the place I live. So I'm delighted to be here.
Well, and it is just such a great coincidence that you're on the Hooked on Startups podcast. I mean, that's the way the world, the universe is giving, clearly.
Yeah, totally. No, delighted to be here, mate. I'd love to share anything I can with your listeners.
Well, I want to just tell everyone a little bit about you, first of all. So you're originally from Ireland, and your journey to the US, I think, has gone through 35 different countries, I think, before you got here. And I want to talk about that later on. But you're the founder of the Expert Dojo, which is based in Santa Monica, which is described as the largest startup high-performance center for entrepreneurs. So this is very different, and we'll come on to that. It's very different to an incubator. You're not a VC. You're not a life coach, as it were. Well, I'm sure you provide all sorts of insights and coaching, but it's a fascinating story how you came about the creation of the dojo, because it's very different to all your other businesses. You're not a career coach, and it was born out of some huge disconnect that you discovered when you arrived in the US. And it's something that I think most people are probably not aware of, and that is the reality behind funding in the US and what you describe as not the lack of the American dream, but the fact that it's the destruction or the disappearance of the American dream.
Yeah, maybe, or like the Ponzi scheme that is entrepreneurship in the United States these days.
And that's a big statement. I mean, that's so describe more what you mean by that.
So, I mean, just going to what you mentioned a couple of moments ago about my past, I'm a service entrepreneur. I love entrepreneurship. I love the part of waking up every single day and discovering something new. And for anybody who's thinking of being an entrepreneur, or is an entrepreneur, we all know that throughout your journey in entrepreneurship, I don't care how successful you are, you always have issues during it, even during the successful times, with money issues or family pressures or all those types of things. It goes with it. But the true journey of being an entrepreneur is so incredibly epic that it overrides anything that could possibly happen. So when I look at other entrepreneurs, it's not that I feel a pride. I just feel this great comradeship when I'm there. And when I see people who are not entrepreneurs, I think, man, it's such a shame, because you just don't know what you're missing. When you go through your work life, you are just trying to make it to the finish line. And it's so sad, because when you get to the finish line, even though you might have done great things in your family and you might have done great things in religion and traveling and all those other great pillars of achievement, you will have missed out the one amazing pillar, which is creativity, being able to create the life that other people live around you. I wanted to just create that foundation. Entrepreneurship for me is an incredible journey. I would categorize myself as a service entrepreneur. So okay. In other words, all of the companies I've had some property development companies in the past, and I've had tech companies as well. But the companies that I've always excelled in are the companies when there's a high interaction level between a service that I provide and the public that are receiving those services.
So you're not creating a fit and forget product. You're talking about an industry where you're actively involved in the development or whatever the service is, and the contact and the you know, the growing your customer base as well. So what you've been involved in, and this is very important, is are businesses where you have to grow your customer base, where you have to nurture them.
Yeah. And you know, the funny thing about entrepreneurship is it hasn't changed much in the last 100 years. Not in the requirements of what it takes to be a great entrepreneur. If you look at phenomenal entrepreneurs today, whether they're Elon Musk or whether they're Richard Branson, and you look at entrepreneurs, Henry Ford, or even going back further, they all form the same characteristics. Like, they find a great idea, they work incredibly hard to get that idea through, they slowly convince people around them of the validity of that idea and turn it then into a product and something that's tangible, and then they stay obsessed with it all the way to the end. And we've entered a world now which I just think is very sad. It's kind of the world of immediacy. It's the world of Kim Kardashian, where if we don't make money in 5 minutes, well, it's not worth doing. If we can't become a $1 billion company, then what's the point in starting it? And we've moved away from the fundamentals of what made great entrepreneurs, which is being able to start that concept, bring it to an idea, bring it into the company, and then create something that would never have been created before if you hadn't done it. And, you know, I make the statement about a Ponzi scheme because it's become a money game. And that's sad, not just on the level of the companies that get engaged with it, but also the companies that get pushed out. So let me start with a slightly confrontational statement. And this is not black and white. My views are merely to provoke conversation, as opposed to saying that such and such is a bad person or this is a bad company. But if we look at Amazon as a stereotypical company, most people would sit around a kitchen table and talk about how Amazon are the greatest, most incredible company in the world, run by a great leader, which they are, and they absolutely dominate. But what people don't realize is that they spent $6 billion losing money over a 10-year period to be able to become the greatest company in the world. So let's look at a couple of different impacts on companies that are around them. Firstly, give me $6 billion. I just think I might be able to make a go of my business, right? And I'm sure many of your listeners would think the same thing. If you just work on the basis of, if we have an unlimited amount of money to throw at this, then it is impossible for the real entrepreneur, that entrepreneur who are prepared to fight their guts out, give a good Conor McGregor performance and push it all the way through, it is impossible for them to win, because nobody can compete with $6 billion being wasted in your business. And the net for Amazon is, while they're losing money over 10 years, while they're buying stuff for a dollar and selling it for 80 cents in relative terms compared to their outgoing expenses, they were driving competitors out of business who had perfectly good profit models. Excellent businesses. Businesses that could have got a margin in. Businesses that actually could have made money and kept the consumer extremely happy. And I think, and again, Amazon is merely a discussion starter, right? I don't want to start a hate campaign against Amazon.
No, but I'm sure, I know exactly what you mean. It's almost like there's a collaboration with companies that fund large companies to say, we can dominate a market space simply by pricing everybody out.
And so it's ridiculous. By the way, Uber is exactly the same case. Awful CEO, sexist, misogynistic individual, ends up getting involved in a company which was a good idea and his idea. But how many billions of dollars have they pumped into Uber to drive out of the market any other rideshare and taxis? Now, I love it for the moment. I love it because I can get to the airport for $20, which I know is not sustainable for them as a company, nor is it sustainable for the driver. But as the consumer, because I am part of the stupid majority, I don't care. And I will encourage that business to come in until all competition is driven away and there just becomes one or two dominant players in the market. And at that stage, the price and the service will not work in our favor.
Well, I disagree with you, because I think if you look at I understand what you're saying, but if you look at the airline industry as a parallel, I remember going back years to when Freddie Laker launched SkyTrain, I think it was. And there was a smear campaign from British Airways, which eventually put him out of business. But what it did is it created this competition, and the airline industry is not a cartel, obviously, but it's an incredibly complicated and competitive space. But what's happened over the years is that the price to the consumer has fallen as a result of competition. But if you go back 20, 30 years, it was a very different place. So maybe what's happening is companies like Uber and Amazon, what they're doing is they're completely shaking up the existing models. And what the market will be in the next 5 to 10 years could be incredibly different to what it is today.
You're right, and this is why this is such a great conversation. My argument is not so much that the consumers lose, although I think we do. I think these days we buy cheap crap, which doesn't last any amount of time, and I believe that, like, the great service that we would have got. For me, the saddest day was when Concorde stopped. It told me that innovation in speed and actually trying to make airlines a better service died that day. You know, British Airways, whether it was the smear campaign in him or Virgin, they suck at smear campaigns. They've got to stop doing that stuff because they always get caught.
And it's fun to read.
My point is more that the one who loses is the entrepreneur, right? Whether it's the entrepreneurs who are competing against them. If you're competing against a company that can inject $6 billion, when you're a startup who's got a great idea and a great company and a great team, it's very hard to compete. And even within, like, I don't want to mention their name because it wouldn't be fair, but we had a subscription-based airline that started here in the US, we'll say. A great idea, great company, great person who started it. But that person was fired out of his own CEO role 3 years after he started the company. Now he's starting a competitive company, I think out of Canada or somewhere, where he's now competing against the same company he founded because the accountants are today's rock stars. The entrepreneur. And that's the problem. The problem is all of these companies, like, we think Jeff Bezos and those guys run Amazon and Travis runs Uber, but they don't. They have tiny percentage shares in the companies. The companies are run by massive venture capital firms who do it. And I just want to add one more point to this. Look, I am not suggesting we destroy venture capital, we destroy money, we take away the capitalist system, we move it. I'm just suggesting that as an early stage entrepreneur, we know the rules of the game. If we know the rules of the game, we know how to play and we know how to do it slightly differently than a lot of entrepreneurs do today. And I think it would have a massive impact on the success rates of entrepreneurs who are starting and not quite making it in business.
I think you're right. The main point here is it's about the landscape. It's about the journey as an entrepreneur. You start with that burning ambition to do something. And you've seen this. And in many cases, you don't know what it was. So you tell the story of being a 9-year-old on the beach with your cans of soda,
Coke, right?
Which is, and I can see
illegally selling Coke because I'm.
That's fine, and I guess what you know. Yeah. Several decades later, it's fine to admit to that because of, but because you can afford the attorneys now. But the important point is, you don't know when you're starting out anything other than the fact that this is what you want to do.
Correct.
And so you're very much at the beginning of what becomes a very long and difficult journey. And you mentioned it very much at the beginning. So you're led to believe, as you rightly say, that the American dream is that if you have this great idea, whether it's in tech or service industry or manufacturing, then there will be this support mechanism around you. That there are people there that will take your idea, that will fund you, support you, train you, teach you, and get your product to market. But what you're saying is, with your experience as an entrepreneur, in the US, and this is just about the US, it's not that at all. So,
yeah, but it's also in Europe as well. I mean, look, the US controls the money, right? That's what makes it such a powerful country. And we have issues here, but in Europe, it's very much the same. If you come from I don't want this to come across that I'm hating on people who come from good families. I come from a good family and I'm proud of where I come from. But it is very biased towards certain demographics. And if we look at the color, the sex, the types of people, where they live, who are the successful billion-dollar companies, it's disproportionate to how many good entrepreneurs that we could have elsewhere. So I do think we have a slightly unfair system because the system is driven by the accountants. It's not driven by the entrepreneurs. Now, I'm not naive enough to think that that's going to change. are that suddenly us entrepreneurs are going to take ownership and change control of the entire society and actually turn it on its head. But I do believe that, and it kind of speaks to the point of why I started Expert Dojo in the first place. I do believe that by understanding the rules, we can create a structure of growth for entrepreneurs, which are built around the rules, which give us the best chance of winning. So what do I mean? Oh, do you want to say
something? I was going to say, let's talk about the problem. Yeah. So we're talking about it in broad terms. There is a problem with funding in the US. And let's take the US as an example, because we're here. And that problem is something that we want to fix. It's not something that we're moaning about. It's something that we've both, or all of us, have discovered. And we think that there's a route to change that. So let's talk about what that problem is. So as an entrepreneur, what is the problem? How does it manifest? How do I begin to realize, as I go through my entrepreneurial journey, that everything is not as I thought it would be?
So look, there are two problems. The first problem is that we're taught to believe that investment is the most important part of an entrepreneurship journey. And that was never the case in the past. You go back 30, 50 years ago, you save some money, you start a business, whether it's a restaurant or an attorney shop or whether it's whatever you're going to do yourself. You start your business, you grow your business, you build it in cash flow. Maybe you go to the bank and get a little bit of money, and then you build up a good, strong business and you invest your money and it goes really well. What's happened today is, unless you have a $1 billion business, you're a failure. That's what we've been told. Yeah. And I don't want to massively parallel to women, but unless you look like Kim Kardashian, then you're not beautiful. If you're a guy, unless you have made like to the top position CEO of your company, then you're failed. Like, we put all these stereotypes.
But what's caused that?
It's us, right? We can't blame
media. Is it social media? Is it this constant exposure to, and let's not spend too much time on this, but is it relatively new because of the impact of social media and because of the exposure that we get and how we're conditioned in our feed bubble to... That explains what the change is and why.
You're right, because we have access to seeing everybody now. So we see the tiny 0.0001% of people, and then we see those people as being all of the people, and then we're not happy if we don't get there. So my realization, first of all, is the problem is that our measurement of what happiness is and what success is way off mark. It's way off mark. Like, if you said to any venture capital, and by the way, there are hardly any that we do not interact with, and I'm friendly with an awful lot of them as well. There are no goodies and baddies in this story. Yeah. It's just about vested interest, right? But if you asked any venture capitalist, what is the worst money that you can possibly take? Everyone will say institutional venture capital money. The worst money. The second you take it, you sell your soul. But entrepreneurs come running for it because they believe that unless they get a company which is worth billions of dollars, they have failed. So our first thing that we have to do is recondition ourselves as to what happiness looks like. You give me a company that makes 150 grand a month, where I'm going to Cancun twice a year, where I'm building up a phenomenal, great bunch of friends, and I'm working 5-6 hours a day. You give that to me for my life any day of the week.
Yeah.
And that's what we're not going to start teaching our kids again, is an entrepreneurship journey is about creating what makes us happy and makes us feel successful. It doesn't have to be what other people see to be successful. Once you do that, the venture capital whole question actually moves away from being such an important issue. Right?
Yeah. And I think what we need to do, and I completely agree, because my major driver of being an entrepreneur for the last 30 something years is freedom. And it's not about the money, because I would prefer to be poor and free, because I know that I'm in control of my own destiny and I can make it work. And I think that's something that I'm definitely trying to teach all of my children to do. But I think the real issue is that we're taught that we should be the Uber of this or the Airbnb of that. And is this something that is cyclical? Do you think that there will come a point? Tell me more about how you and Expert Dojo, in your world, how you're changing that.
Right. So firstly, I'm an entrepreneur like you for a lot of years. I think maybe 20 years, right? And then I arrived over here in LA, had lived in multiple different cities, was in New York for a long time, which is a great sober. I love New York for that reason, because you just know where there are problems straight away. And then I arrived in LA, and everybody kept talking about unicorns and finding billion-dollar businesses and us taking over the world and this great entrepreneurship phenomenal bubble that we have here, but a positive bubble in that they're all coming in and it's going to create something great. And all I saw was failure. I hadn't met many people who had successfully exited businesses. We'd had two or three successful, I'll say in inverted commas, entrepreneurs who'd exited for $20, $30 million businesses, but they only had 10, 15% left in their business by the time they exited. So what did they make? $2 million, $3 million for an 8-year exit? I don't know. I don't call that a huge success. I would say that's pretty hard work if it's one of our best. So my realization was everybody's failing. And the more people I spoke to, the more I kind of went on this journey of trying to understand why nobody was talking about the massive failure rate in early stage startup. I mean, it's as high as 95% in some tech sectors. 95%. I mean, who, and let me give an Irish analogy here. None of my friends would go to the bar with a 95% chance of not getting a beer. It just wouldn't happen. So yeah. Why the heck would anybody start a business with a 95% chance of failing? Go on, yeah.
Is it because the type of businesses that they're trying to set up are designed so that they will be attractive to VC? So it's the tail wagging the dog.
I just think 95% is a very high number.
Yeah, but what I'm saying though, are they failing though? Because the types of businesses that are being set up.
So let me tell you the conclusions we came to. So okay. For the first 6 months over here, we didn't charge anybody anything. I opened up a place on the top of Santa Monica Mall, 8,000 square foot facility, brought in some phenomenal coaches and partners. We brought in 100 startups, and the only thing we did was study them. So we said to these startups, good news and bad news. The good news is that we're going to study you for the next 3-4 months, and it's not going to cost you a dime. The bad news is we're going to study you for the next 3-4 months, and we're going to dissect every single thing that you do. And we found a couple of areas. Now, some obvious, some not so obvious. And I think it'll start a good conversation on this. The obvious ones, startups do not get educated in school. This is a huge problem. We're being taught curriculum, which goes back 40 years. It's just not good. And I look, my boys go to public school here. My boy goes to public school. I have tremendous respect for anyone who goes in as a teacher. I love those guys. I know most of them do it with their heart. But the curriculum they're teaching our kids is not preparing our kids for what the world looks like today. And today the world is an entrepreneurial mindset world. So we have entrepreneurs waking up on a Tuesday morning and saying, I have a great idea. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to be an entrepreneur. It's like, dude, you know nothing about starting your own business. You know nothing about branding, product fit, market validation, business development, user growth. And then they go, no, you don't get it. You don't get it. I worked for this company and I sold $7 million worth of their products. Great. Well done. Just because you sold a product successfully for a company does not mean that you can own a company that sells a product successfully. They are entirely different places. But they how can the entrepreneur have a different perspective? Because they never got taught in school what the process looks like. And even in colleges and with the MBA programs, much of them are hypothetical. You know, studies on how Microsoft did what they did. Yeah, okay. But Bill Gates was a rich guy with a rich daddy who had a rich garage and set him up for his first couple of companies. No disrespect, but that doesn't relate to me. I'm different. And it definitely doesn't relate to the kids who are coming through the system right now who are looking at an entirely different system as to what he was looking at there. So number one, we found education within school is huge and we need to fix it. And until we do fix it, we built our own education here. Number two, we found out community is a disaster. In the US, I would rank our community, and if I call community as assisting startups to assisting the most important part of our business sector to be successful, it is one of the worst in the world. If I was going to take Ireland, I would say we're far worse. If I was going to take Israel, I would say they absolutely rock in it.
So despite all of the meetup groups that are occurring,
I'm talking support. I'm not talking about a bunch of people sitting around a table talking about what makes them happy. I'm talking about, do we have, so I'll give you a great example. We are working with one of the large, I definitely don't say the name because I really like these guys. We're working with one of the really large logistical companies that transport a lot of stuff around the US, right? Yeah. And we were speaking to them about them creating an accelerator. And the conversation started with them hearing from other accelerators that what they should do is large events, have a large presence, give some money as sponsorship, and get involved in that way. My suggestion is that particular company probably have 30,000 providers. who will kiss their ass on a daily basis to keep every contract that they have with them, because they are probably, for half of them, the most important company that they currently provide for. So all they would have to do is send one email to every single provider to say, all of the companies that we pretty much support are startups, or are people who are transporting logistical products in a business. We want every single one of you to support 5 startups in some way. Yeah. Mentor, coach, be nice. Go into a Starbucks and see one of them there and ask if you can help. Add one of them as your suppliers for one of the goods that you have. I'm not talking charity here. I'm talking a integrated system where the community works together to grow the weakest, so that they then remember us as they get stronger, and then the whole society gets better. Because I'll just add one point to this. These unicorns do not help our local communities. They take jobs which will be temporary. They give jobs which will be temporary jobs because the flux in their business means it's impossible to plan. They take space which will be temporary space. And most of the money that comes in doesn't come into the community. So I would say, like, that part of it for us was a real opportunity to say to our local companies, if you want to support local companies, local taxes being paid, local real startups being given a chance, like, just do the right thing. It's easy. It's not hard, but it has to be part of your DNA. And it has to be part of the DNA of the large companies in the area. It has to be part of the DNA of the local government who are working within their local communities. And actually, the large unicorns should also be supporting them as well, because they came from it. So I mentioned Israel. They do it really well. They've had Startup Nation for 20 years. If you're Cisco or Microsoft in Israel, you do not even think of not supporting their local community. And that's why they're so hot over there. Third thing we found out, Lean Startup is and I'm not going to broad stroke, because I usually do, and it's probably a little bit unfair, but Lean Startup can be a destructive force within startup. Because what is
that, just tech or startups generally?
Well, especially outside tech. But inside tech, I think it's destructive anyway. And the reason is this. A lot of them, the methodology in Lean Startup is sixth grade school, right? There's nothing hard in it. Do the 5 whys. It goes back to a time well before Lean Startup. Don't spend a lot of money. Great. Okay, fine.
Yeah.
Change things if it's wrong. Yeah, okay, we get that. Here's where it's destructive. Today, more than ever before, you need an authentic brand for your business. If you do not build a strong brand for your business, the chances of you being long-term, sustainably successful is almost zero. So Lean Startup pretty much don't like brand. Business planning. If you do not build a roadmap for your business from the beginning all the way through, it's the same. Well, the methodology in Lean Startup is rapid prototype as quick as you can. Don't procrastinate. Don't wait. Go straight to the rapid prototype. But what's the problem with that? The problem is, what am I going to do? I'm in Third Street Promenade here in LA. I'm going to open an Irish restaurant because I think everybody's going to love Irish stew. But it's totally cool if nobody loves it, because next week I'm going to change it to an Italian restaurant. And you know what? If that doesn't work, totally cool, because I'm going to change it to a key shop and we're going to change people. It's just not practical in the world. It's not practical for tech because it's too expensive to build an app. And if you build it wrong, you're screwed. And it's not practical outside tech. It's just a trendy philosophy that everybody's latched onto because the big guys in San Francisco reckon it's a good thing to do.
That's a very important point, because what we're talking about here is pivoting. But there's a difference between pivoting and being agile, as the expression is, which takes you further towards the ultimate outcome, which is the realization of your vision.
Yeah.
And basically, the opposite to that, which is what you were talking about just then, is saying, well, look, if that doesn't work, I'll just try something else because I'm an entrepreneur. But what people don't understand or haven't really fully taken on board is that, you know, being an entrepreneur hasn't actually changed over 200 years or whatever it is. I mean, bits of it change, and the press and the, you know, what you read on social media. Entrepreneur does not equal unemployed or unemployable.
Yeah.
It actually equals
business genius.
Yeah, I think you're right. And so what do you spend most of your time doing at Expert Dojo?
So it's a hard one for me. I was going to say the last thing we found out four things. The last thing that we found out was there's a toxic relationship with investment, that a lot of startups end up coming in. It's not just the investor's fault. The startups come in, they come in weak, they come in uneducated, they come in ill-prepared, and they come in begging for money. And they're a little bit like Oliver Twist saying, please, sir, can I have some more? And what we need to do is become strong as entrepreneurs, build up a good value proposition, build up some traction in our business, make sure that we're the ones who are in control when we're looking for the money, and then build a relationship.
How do you choose which guys to bring in? Because there must be some type of process that an applicant has to go through to be accepted. Otherwise, you're just going to be overrun with people with crazy ideas.
Yeah. So to answer your question just before that, and then I'll run into it, I wake up at about 4:15 every morning. I'll normally do my emails from about 4:15 through till about 6:45. I then get my little kid out of bed. I bring him up to his school. I get into, which is something that I've written into my, that I never miss, because I don't want one, I don't want to look back in 20 years and see that I've missed another big pillar of my life. So I take him to school. I then come over to our dojo over here, which is it's a pre-accelerator. We also have an accelerator, which I'll talk about in a sec as well. But I'll come over here and I'll start working with entrepreneurs. I will not look at my email definitely until 5 o'clock. We have about 35, 40 events every single month. Last night we had an event for about 600 people. Over at the dojo. So normally then I'll get back to the house, or I'll normally finish at about 7 or 8 o'clock. And then at 7 or 8 o'clock, I'll try and get a game of tennis in, and then get back to the house at about 8:30, 9, have a bit of dinner, relax. I'm in bed by 10:30. And then 10:30, and then I'm up at 4:30 the next morning again. And I love every single second of it. So on the other point of the dojo and the types of people that we bring through, We have three levels within the dojo. The first level is educational. So we have online and offline classes. We call them milestone sprints, growth hacking courses, and find investment courses. And we also have individual workshops as well. Now, the milestone sprint is just a 10-week course that helps an entrepreneur go from inception of an idea to being ready. We make sure their brand is ready. We make sure their product fit is ready. We make sure the user acquisition plan is in place and everything else. Most importantly, we make sure that their milestone plan is in ready. So we build an 18-month plan, month by month, revenue, users, prospects, and activities, which then fall into a marketing plan below that, month by month, for what they have to hit to get to their 18-month plan. And the reason we do this, and I want this for, this is everything I've learned in entrepreneurship in 20 years is in this next statement. 18 months is the key period for an entrepreneur to actually make it or not. Now, what normally happens during a life cycle of an entrepreneur? First 4 or 5 months, we spend all of our time messing around, getting t-shirts, getting business cards, telling everybody we're CEO, dealing with our product, making sure that everybody knows that we are now taking over the world. Then we get to month 7 and we start building relationships, telling people about our product, pushing it out. But because most entrepreneurs are creatives, not business development people, those entrepreneurs are not focusing on strong business development. By month 18, most of us have run out of money. And entrepreneurs do not fail because of a bad idea. I think you made a great point earlier on. Don't fail because of a bad idea. Don't fail because of a bad team. Don't fail because of a bad process. Because as long as we have two good ears, within time, we can fix that. It's a bit like Amazon, right? Give me 10 years. And with enough people telling me, Brian, the course should not be $600. It should be $399. Then I'm going to try $399 one time. What kills us is runway.
Yeah.
So if we don't pivot long enough, quick enough, fast enough to get within 18 months to be earning enough money to pay our expenses, pay ourselves, and cover for Murphy's Law kicking us in the ass, we're screwed, because we then end up driving an Uber and saying, we're not going to give up, we're going to keep going, but we just can't do it now in the evening because we're driving an Uber. And slowly by slowly by slowly, it fades away.
And just to be absolutely clear, this 18-month course is not some kind of preconditioning to make your company ready for investment.
No.
What you're talking about is teaching people how to run a business.
How to run a business. That's it. And how to also put fundamentals into the business. And it's only a 10-week course, but they have an 18-month milestone that they build in, which they'll run themselves afterwards. We want to just really allow, you mentioned Agile before. We love Agile. We love a lot of the philosophies that go around, like the philosophies that management consultants have used for years, such as balanced scorecard, stand-up meetings, like really good, and even within tech where you've got strong Scrum methodology. So for us, we want a startup to realize it's really hard work and it is a sprint. It's not a marathon. It's a sprint every single day until you make it to that 18-month figure. And if you can make it there in 16 months or 14 months, then you're going to kill it. If you can't, you're going to be in big trouble. So we have a lot of people go through that course. A lot of people actually ask us to go through the Find Investment course, and we won't let them. We'll force them to go through the other course because we say it's not a smoke and mirrors game. It's about that. And then those companies we love, after we've seen them for 4, 5, 6 months, after we've seen their milestones, then we give them the opportunity to join our venture studio. We take a tiny percentage in the company, like 2%, and nothing too crazy. But we commit to working with them infinitum until they get to the place that they need to go to. And we never charge them a dime after that. So companies really like that. But we have to make sure, we want to make sure, like you can't make a decision on a company on a first date, which is what a lot of investors do. You have to be able to see those companies over a period of time, watch how they move, watch how they change, and see what they adapt into. So we love that. And we just raised a small fund where now we're going to be putting $50,000 investments into the companies that we feel just need a little boost as well.
I mean, how do you keep the VCs away?
Oh, we don't. No, we don't. We don't keep them away at all. We actually, here's the ironic thing about all of this. We host the largest VC pitch event in the United States. We have more VCs. Today alone, I've had 5 VCs come through Expert Dojo. We don't. They love our message.
But do you not feel a little protective of your company? So having got them on the straight and narrow, as it were, and got them to understand about their business, do you feel like you're throwing, you know, lambs to the slaughter?
No, because we're really honest. I'm at a stage in my life. I can't say my whole life I was the most wonderful, great person. But I think you reach a stage in your life where you say, you know, I'm getting old. I'm getting too old to start having to think about who I lied to and who I didn't lie to and everything else. Why don't I just pick a side? So I had a conversation with an investor yesterday who wanted to invest in a company. And he said to me, and he wants to put $3 million into it. And he said, look, I want to take a 50% stake in the company. And I said, you can't have it because the company is valued at $10 million and I'm not going to reduce it down. And he said, I bet you if you speak to your startup, then your startup will accept my offer. And I said, I bet you he will too. But if he does, I'll resign and I'll give back our 2% equity stake because I don't want to work with an idiot. So we're very protective of our startups. We know who our friends are, but by doing the right job by the startups, what happens is we get better success rates. And at the end of the day, the investors are not looking for more friends. They're not looking for anything. They're just looking for a better return on the money than they could have got before. And if they can get that in the dojo and they can deal with people that they know what's coming at them, they're fine with it.
And I think that's, so what you're doing is you're actually making the system work, because what they're doing at the moment is they're taking mud, throwing it up against the wall and seeing what sticks. And they have a 1 in 20, 1 in 30 success rate, something like that at the moment. So in other words, companies that they invest in, they know, or they in their figures, they're forecasting that, you know, 95% of the capital that they put in probably isn't going to work. But that 5% that does is going to give them their 10 or 100x return. And the problem with that is that if you go into this VC sausage machine, what happens is you get the initial euphoria of getting your valuation and being funded by a VC, but you effectively bring on, you invite Satan onto your board. And secondly, when you've run out of capital and you need your second round to keep the momentum going, they say, well, no, we don't want to invest, or we did invest, but we want to reduce your valuation. So what you're doing though is you're preventing all of those sort of mistakes. You're guiding the guys in the early stage, you're educating them, you're allowing them to build a solid business that has value. You're teaching them about what the VCs are going to say and how to work with VCs. So by the time they get the investment, they're in much better shape to make use of that. And they can punch back effectively.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. And it's a beautiful journey to be on. We're not the only people on this journey. There's a lot of people trying to search for solutions on how to improve startup success. Our personal mission is to make 1 million startups $1 million. Very simple. You know, not $1 billion or $10 billion, like 1 million startups $1 million. And there's a lot of other people out there trying to do the same thing. And just my kind of plea to entrepreneurs everywhere is just be careful. You know, it's not, just be careful with everybody. Be careful with us. Be careful with anyone who surrounds you during your entrepreneurial journey. Just be super careful with, because they'll take your money real fast.
And I guess also your ideas will become theirs. How do you see this changing? So I want to talk just briefly about crowdfunding, because crowdfunding is an alternative form of capital raising. You know, the whole idea behind the Jobs Act 3 years ago was to create a democratic way of raising capital for these startups. Now, it hasn't had a full start as such, but it hasn't had the same growth that everyone was expecting. And that may just be a function of time. But do you see crowdsourcing, crowdfunding, these types of platforms really kicking in and being a major benefit to startups?
Yes. I see crowdfunding a little bit like Apple Pay or Google Glasses, right? Phenomenal ideas that you look at and you think, my goodness, everybody's going to do this. But for some reason, people kept paying with the same money they used to before. And crowdfunding is a little bit like that. The idea of it is wonderful, that everybody can invest in whatever companies and whatever they want to invest in, as opposed to the few select, few privileged people. So I love the concept of it. And there's a lot of platforms which have come up which are incredibly legitimate, who are doing a really good job, who've brought like Start Engine, WeFunder, and a few others, who've brought really good investors on their platform. Here are the two problems that you've got. Number one, people don't trust a internet page.
No, you're right.
So if you say to me, hey, Brian, you got 25K spare? Yeah, maybe. Right. Here's an internet page of a company with a video of a guy which is beautifully produced, like a $30,000 video. He's been airbrushed and everything. The guy looks great. He's got assistants and everybody looking adoringly at them. They have a business plan, which he wrote. They have a value proposition, which he wrote. They have an executive summary, which he wrote. Oh, they have a presentation deck, which he wrote. And like, you're going to see very few of those, which are going to say, you know what, investors, I got to be honest with you, I'm not sure this is going to fly.
No, building trust is one of the hardest things.
It's
building
very
trust online for any type of crowdfunding campaign.
It's very different, right? So, but there's a couple of things happening as well. Like, firstly, we have a new generation coming through, and that generation are getting more used to this way of working. So I think by just natural attrition, it will catch on. Secondly, there are a lot of evangelists behind this and a lot of corporations who are now getting into it as well. So they're starting to drive it through. Thirdly, I just think sometimes we look at the two extremes and say, does one work or does the other work? And sometimes it's not quite so much black and white, it's gray. So for example, what we did is we created an investors club, a little bit like Motley Fool. And we said, as a early stage investor, honestly, you got no chance. Like, if you think you're going to pick the next Google, mate, you are dreaming, because it's not as simple as just saying, is it a right guy with a right idea and is it going to take off? There are things you have to know that you just don't know. So we've started off this club so we can start helping and educating and guiding, and then also bring startups out on a roadshow so they can start to meet investors in Charlotte and New Orleans and all these cities that are not New York, San Francisco, LA, and actually have them have access to it. And our message to them is pretty simple. Never invest a lot of money into it. Never invest more than 2, 3, 4% of what you can afford to put into early stage startup, because it's risky. But then secondly, let us educate you. Let other people educate you. We'll tell you the difference between a safe and a convertible note. We'll tell you the difference between a startup which has a good chance just based on probability. Like, and again, for those people in the know, just, you know, a dating app has got slightly less probability than maybe a SaaS platform. Yes. For building security, right? Not that one is better or worse, but as an early stage investor, you just need to understand the probability factors. So I do. I think it's a lot of education. You'll see a lot more companies like ours coming out with investor clubs and ways for investors to actually just find out more about it and become smarter investors. And when that happens, crowdfunding will definitely explode.
And again, just the impact of cryptocurrencies. I mean, and again, it's very, very early stage and no one really knows what these are, I don't think. in mainstream. But do you detect, do you get faint signals from the future?
With
regard to cryptos and ICOs?
Listen, if you'd spoken to me 4 months ago, I would have told you that the most geeky thing that we were into was bots, right? Chatbots and artificial intelligence. Today, it is without question cryptocurrency. We are going deep into it. We've taken on three or four excellent companies in this space. One of our companies is trying to create the next exchange after Coinbase and Gemini, a company called Xcoins. Awesome company. So by getting involved here, it's that opportunity. And again, look, it's the same caveat. A lot of people are going to lose a lot of money on all of the different currencies which are out there in the crypto field. But some people in the know are going to make tens of millions of dollars. So you want to educate yourself as much as possible, get into the space, get involved in it, go to the conferences, understand how it works. I think it's a fascinating, incredible area, which at the beginning, it was kind of the upstart trying to disrupt money. But today, the larger institutions in the world are taking Bitcoin. Amazon have accepted Bitcoin for years for gift cards. Yes. Nevada just put a law in place that any of their businesses that accept Bitcoin will pay lower sales tax.
Wow, okay. So, and that's the beginning. And my last sort of question here really is for businesses that come to you, how valuable is it for them that they can take advantage of the fact that you see all these different businesses and all these different sectors? Because there must be so many clear common learnings that come out of that. Just describe the sort of value that that brings to a startup who may think that they have the answer to everything, that they don't need mentors, they don't need training, they don't need this type of stuff because they're going to do it on their own. How important is it to slap them around the face and say, look, you know, you need to come and talk to us?
It's very tough for a startup because it's the first time in our lives that we take control for our own actions. If we work in a job, we just get told to do every single day and it's okay. But when we have an idea, a creation, our creation, and we've brought it to the world, and then some Irish schmuck tells you that your idea is crap, you know, it's not, a lot of the time, it's a state of mind. I base every bit of advice we do in exactly what you said there. None of us have a crystal ball, but we do have a very good swing on probability. So we know what's worked before, what hasn't worked before, what projects are going through, what the VCs are investing in, what the good mergers and acquisitions are happening within what which particular sectors. And for example, if a person comes through to build a tech product and they want it to be a $1 billion product and they've never been in the tech space before and they don't have a CTO, we know that there is zero chance of anybody investing in this company ever unless it's their mom's friend. Now, do people listen to that straight away? It depends. Look, we can only be as honest and about our feelings. And I'll normally ask for permission when I'm speaking to people about, can I be as direct as we can? And we ask our other coaches to do the same thing. Sometimes people aren't ready. Sometimes they are. And that's why we built the online course, because we thought, look, they won't agree with everything they see. But if somebody picks up some great ideas about how to differentiate themselves in branding, if they market validate a little bit more, if they focus more on the customer journey on their website, if they put together a better acquisition plan to get users, which just doesn't just involve paid, if they just pick up a few of those things, it'll make a difference in their business, for sure.
That's brilliant. Well, that's good. Anyway, well, look, we're moving on to the rapid fire questionnaire section now. So I hope you're prepared for this.
Hit me.
So, 10 questions that I've borrowed from James Lipton of Inside the Actors Studio. I just like to make sure that he knows that I'm borrowing his stuff. So the first question is, what is your favorite word?
Success.
What is your least favorite word? Failure. What are you most excited about right now?
Early stage startups. I love it. All of it. I mean, I could say Bitcoin, right? But I just love all early stage. Honestly, anyone who comes through the door who's an early stage startup, I love it. Anyone who walks through the door and they have a job, I get really bored. So I just love early stage startup. And I could say Bitcoin because it's our favorite space right now. But you give me a geeky product which is changing something. Like, we work with a guy here who invented the clapper. Like, seriously, the clapper for the likes. So, and we work with a guy who invented the Velcro wallet. So that's all of this. I'll take all of it. Anything in early stage startup.
So what turns you off right now?
Uneducated startups.
What sound or noise do you love?
Sound or noise that I love. We have a gong in here when somebody gets investment. It's a dark joke. Considering that you borrowed from Lipton, we borrowed from the Japanese.
Well, so, I can just imagine, because you're in the you're in a shopping mall in Santa Monica. I'm just wondering what your neighbors think when they hear this gong going on.
They like it more than the evening parties.
Yeah. Well, so what sound or noise do you hate?
I hate alarm clocks.
Well, it doesn't sound like you need one, actually, bearing in mind you work on sort of 20 minutes sleep every night. So what is your favorite curse word?
Oh, well, I'm Irish, so I live by the F word. I just live by it.
And that seems to be the favorite. I should probably do a poll, actually, but that is, you know, still the most flexible.
Feels
word.
Very authentic. Like it when does. I really want to get down to the root of something, it just feels very authentic. And my other favorite word is, after I've said it and I knew my 10-year-old was close to me, it's sorry.
Yes. Yeah. I know. That is a curse word in its own right. So what profession other than your own would you like to attempt?
I would have loved to have been a professional tennis player, but I can't. I got to tell you, that was in the past. If I wasn't doing early stage startups, I would just not be able to think of anything to do.
Yes.
There's nothing else. And I really wish, I think it's such a gift for people to be able to do this. I hope that as many of your listeners can get into this space. By the way, I wasn't always in this space. I had plenty of shitty companies that I ran that I made money from, and it was okay. But I definitely wasn't this happy. Like, you should always search for the one thing that makes you really happy. And then you don't need to search anymore. Like, if you're really, really, really happy and you're just right there and away from the tip of happiness, that's pretty good. You've beaten most people. So I'll take it. I'll take where I am now.
That's brilliant. And what profession would you not like to attempt?
Anything else. I'm not taking anything else. I'm just doing early stage startup as my answer to both of those questions.
And that is your final answer.
That is my final answer. I don't need friends or family.
My last question then is, if heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say when you arrive at the pearly gates?
That is the most incredible exit of $400 million I've ever seen. How did you come up with that idea?
When you get kudos from God for an exit, that's pretty good going, I think.
I'll be going for a subsequent investment.
Well, Brian, I can't begin to thank you. It's been just fascinating talking to you.
It's been awesome.
Now, just let me know, how do people get in touch with you? How do they find out about the milestone plans, about your training, about all of these programs that you run? How do they take advantage of what you're offering?
Perfect. So anyone can catch us on expertdojo.com, expertdojo.com. And it's just in programs. If you look at programs, you see the Milestone Sprint, the Accelerator, the Venture Studio. It's all there. We always, always, always reply back to people. You know, whether it's info@expertdojo.com or my personal email, which I'm happy to give out, which is brian@expertdojo.com. Always reach out. Even if you've got, look, forget the programs. Even if you're just having a shitty day and you're not quite sure what to do, shoot us over an email and one of us will come back to you and hopefully give you a bit of advice.
That's brilliant. Well, Brian, thank you. It's been a pleasure. And, look forward to speaking to you again soon.
Thanks, buddy. I look forward to that beer.
Okay, talk to you soon.